afternoon, 96-3707, CBS versus Lurk. Appearing for the plaintiff appellant petitioner, CBS, is James Ratzen. Ms. Ratzen, are you ready to proceed? Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Ratzel, representing the petitioner CBS and Kemper Insurance. Good afternoon. I want to start out with just discussing the factual background, because in this particular case it's very significant given the decision of the Court of Appeals. The worker, Camps, was employed as a runner over at the Winter Olympics by CBS. He was specifically assigned to the luge and bobsled. As the court is aware, this accident occurred on a ski hill. He was not assigned to the ski hill, nor did he have any official duties pertaining to that ski hill. On one particular day when the luge was not operating, or there was no need for his services, CBS essentially gave him the day off. This is undisputed. The transcript of the hearing is clear that Camps himself admits that he could do whatever he wanted to on that day. CBS did not place any controls on him, any restrictions on him, didn't tell him what he could or could not do. This was a classic case in which he had a day off and he could do whatever he wanted to.
He wasn't on call?
He was not on call. There's been an argument raised that he's on call, but the original Lurk decision didn't even make that finding. What happened was, there's argument that, well, if the producers had to get a hold of him, could they get a hold of him? The answer is obviously yes. But that's no different than saying, I'm on call when I'm at home on the weekend cutting my grass. If my partners in my firm want to get a hold of me, they know how to get a hold of me, but that doesn't make me on call. Given the fact that the employer has said you can do whatever you wanted to, that is hardly a characterization of somebody being on call. On call to me implies that that person must be at a specific location, must report in, must be accessible. In this case, the only fact is that he could do whatever he wanted to. He could have become invisible for that entire day, and it would have nothing to do with his employment.
He could have gone to Copenhagen and not left a forwarding address or telephone number.
He could have done that. The testimony is clear from Mr. Camps himself that he could do whatever he wanted to do, and that CBS did not place any restrictions. So I think it's an erroneous argument to say, well, did the supervisor know where you were if they had to get a hold of you?
Well, here the supervisor suggested that they would go skiing and the vehicles were provided by CBS, as I recall. Isn't that factually correct?
That is correct. Unless I misunderstood, the vehicle, in other words, some basic transportation, was provided by CBS.
By the employer.
Yes. But that wasn't for any particular activity. That was just a reality of the fact that CBS had a large contingent of employees there and a large amount of equipment. So they made as a perk saying, if you need to go anywhere, there are vehicles here. Now, with regard to the skiing, that's another significant factual dispute that exists. There's been information written and arguments made that he was provided with lift tickets by CBS. There is no substantial or credible evidence in the record to indicate the lift tickets were provided by CBS. The testimony is he would go to the ski hill, show him the CBS credential, and they in turn would give him a free lift ticket. There's even testimony they would give him a discount on equipment. What that is, it's not a benefit by CBS. That is a business decision made by the owner of the ski hill. That is no different than a local bar or restaurant may say, if you show us your ticket stub from the Badger football game, I will give you a free drink. Now, if a person takes advantage of that, that doesn't make the University of Wisconsin a participant in the operation of that bar. In this case, The only evidence is that the worker testified, yes, I would show my CBS credential and I would get a free lift ticket and some discount on equipment.
Can I ask you where these factual, what you characterize as factual errors arose? It appears that, for example, Judge Snyder may have those quote-unquote facts within his opinion. As I remember it, they are not the facts that you are challenging are not in the ALJ's opinion. Are they in the Lurk opinion?
They are not in the Lurk opinion.
Okay.
The Lurk opinion simply indicates...
But they are in Judge Snyder's opinion, is that right?
Yes.
Is that where they first are?
I believe so. I think that's where some of the switching of the words, and I'm sure it's all innocent by all parties involved, but at some point this case evolved from a case in which a worker presents proof of I'm an employee and the owner of the ski hill suddenly gives him a ticket. Somehow that's been transformed into a situation where CBS, the employer, is alleged to have actually provided the ski hill.
The Court of Appeals simply used the same kinds of quote-unquote findings that Judge Snyder used in his trial court opinion, is that right?
That's correct.
Now, let me ask you, who is the determiner of the fact? Is it the ALJ or is it Lurk? Or both?
It would be Lurk. There's case law to indicate that essentially Lurk is the body that makes the decision, even though the ALJ is the person that hears the case.
So the issue in terms of these facts is what is contained in the Lurk opinion, and then Judge Snyder's standard of review is the same as ours, is that right?
That is correct. As a reviewing court, essentially the standard would be the same. But the transcript in this matter, which I think is before this body, also identifies that there was no lift ticket provided by CBS. In fact, candidly, the record is ambiguous on that point.
Well, but the finding of Lurk in page 120 is, quote, if I got the right thing, which I think I did, of the appendix is, quote, the employer also provided the applicant and the others with a free ski lift pass, which the applicant did not need to perform any part of his job.
That's correct. Lurk has made that finding, but there is no evidentiary basis for that.
You're just starting to say that it's ambivalent, that it's ambiguous.
It's ambiguous when you look at the actual transcript of the hearing.
That's the finders of facts prerogative to when there's something that's ambiguous to decide which way they think it's right.
I think the...
You don't think there's any evidence to support this?
On the review... The administrative agency has to have substantial and credible evidence upon which to base a finding of fact. In this case, if there's complete ambiguity, in other words, the issue was never broached, the agency cannot simply pick between two unknowns and speculate, well, I think this is the case, because then it fails the test of requiring substantial and credible evidence. In this particular case, the testimony in the transcript does not specifically say CBS provided the ticket. All it says was the credential was presented and I was presented with a free lift ticket. Now, is it possible CBS had an arrangement with the ski hill? That's a possibility. Is it possible that a local business operating the ski hill takes advantage of a huge corporation being in its little town and gives perks to this big business in the town? That's equally possible.
Did the big business know it? Does the big business have a policy that we don't take perks for our employees because we don't want them obligated to anyone?
There's no evidence in the record concerning any types of perks. All that's known is if you had a CBS credential, you could go to this ski hill and the operator of that ski hill would give you a lift ticket. I even asked the worker, well, what if you were part of the Japanese television crew? Would the same thing happen? And the worker said, I don't know.
This is all in your appendix, is it? 129, the questions and answers. Or it's the appendix for the petition for review.
Yes, it should be in the testimony.
Counsel, is it your position that traveling employees can engage in personal recreational activities and remain within the scope of their employment as long as the personal recreational activities are not unreasonably risky?
I think the statute is clear in narrowly limiting what an employee can do outside of the more routine work duties. So in terms of recreation, I think the case law identifies allowable recreation where the circumstances of the employment are such that that can be considered reasonably necessary for living. For example, there was...
So are we then in part battling on the term of, on the issue of whether or not downhill skiing is a reasonable recreational activity in which to engage, in which a traveling employee could engage in and still remain within the scope of employment? Is that in part what we're battling on here?
I think what you're battling is downhill skiing reasonably necessary for living? Because I don't think there's any dispute that the first part of 102.03, the pertinent part, says that you're covered for what you do while traveling, except when on a personal or private pursuit. Clearly, when he's downhill skiing, of any activity he chose on that day, he could have gone shopping, or restaurants, he could have sat in his hotel room.
Is going shopping reasonably necessary for living when you are... Now that might really provide an area of debate. And what's a reasonable shopper is beyond the pale of his case. But... A reasonable shopper, you say, that's necessary for living. In your opinion, shopping, if you're a traveling employee, shopping is necessary for living. Is that right?
No. I think that there have been activities that, if you look at the progression of the statute and the case law, there is really a void as to discussion concerning recreation per se. But there is a recognition. For instance, the case cited by... the respondents, this basketball game out in Oregon, it's an Oregon court case. That court in that case even identifies, well, this individual had 12 hours at a long seminar. It's essentially expected that the person may need to just walk and, you know, refresh themselves. Now, so under certain limited circumstances, an argument can be made that, yes, beyond eating and sleeping, which are clearly activities reasonably necessary for living, there might be certain other activities.
If this boils down to an interpretation of what's reasonable and what may be reasonable in terms of, you know, I had 12 long hours as opposed to 10 long hours as opposed to someone else having 2 short hours and they went to a basketball game, that all seems so relative. Why don't we just say in this case, look, given the standard, given a deferential standard of review, given that Lurk has special expertise in there involved, that we defer to their determination of reasonableness?
Because their interpretation, I have twofold. Number one, their interpretation necessarily involves an interpretation of the statute. I think the statute is quite clear, and it says, if you are engaged in a personal pursuit, there's no coverage. So you start with the first premise that if this worker is engaged in a personal pursuit, there's no coverage.
But doesn't that beg the question? I mean, there's a presumption that everything he's doing while away is in fact employment, and he's allowed to do those kinds of things that are necessary for life. And if recreation is part of that, you know, whatever that is. Whether this is a personal pursuit or part of recreation that's necessary for league, I mean, it depends how it gets back to what Justice Bradley indicated, that why not leave the expertise and the deference to Lurk in making that determination?
Only because I will give Lurk deference in those matters pertaining to the actual employment. In other words, Lurk can determine who the employer was. Lurk can determine what the correct wage is. Those are things that are routinely addressed by Lurk. Here, Lurk is being asked to interpret what is necessary for life.
Well, let me ask you a secondary question to some of Justice Bradley's questions. Let her ask another one. In terms of recreation, so it's your position that some recreation is part of it, is covered, and some is not?
My position would be, there would be a clear presumption, given the statute, there's clearly a presumption that recreation does not fall within the confines of what is reasonably necessary for living.
And where do you find that presumption in the statute?
From the plain wording of the statute. When I read the statute, I don't see that statute as being ambiguous in saying if you are engaged in a private or personal pursuit, you are not covered under the Workers' Comp Act.
Well, Judge Brown's opinion, the Court of Appeals, is that in fact recreation is part of the necessity for living. That exercising, you know, some people running on a daily basis is part of, is as important as eating to them.
I think what happens then is you call upon the agency, LURC, then, to just delve into the realm of speculation in terms of, all right, well, what type of recreation? This individual was engaged in downhill skiing, which I see as an activity posed with some risk. We don't know the level of expertise or experience of this skier. We don't know the conditions. What essentially the court, what troubles me in the court's decision in all respect is the court wouldn't even rule out cliff diving and said, doesn't necessarily make cliff diving compensable, implying that under certain cases, the Court of Appeals would find cliff diving to be compensable under the Workers' Comp Act. And I think that is an interpretation that does not comport with the plain language of the statute. If the legislature wanted to cover recreation or activities that are clearly personal, there's no question that a person has to eat. That's incidental to living.
What's the standard of review on this issue that we're discussing?
I think you can give deference to LURC to some extent, but you clearly have the ability to provide a proper statutory interpretation.
So how much deference? What are we talking about here?
To the extent that this court wishes to import expertise to LURC in the field of determining what's necessary for living, the court can give that whatever weight it accords it, but clearly the ability of this court to interpret the statute and whether the facts determined by LURC have been properly applied to the statute and the statute has been properly interpreted, I think this court has the ability to review this de novo because it really doesn't involve a question of the findings of fact. We know what the facts are. The question is, all right, given the facts, how do they apply to the statute as written?
One of my problems is the statute as written is almost impossible to interpret. It starts out saying anything you do when you're away is part of the services, comma. That's the first part. Then it says, except when engaged in a deviation for a private or personal purpose. Okay. So then we get to ordinary lunch, may or may not be a personal or private deviation. Then it says acts necessary, reasonably necessary for living, or incidental to thereto. So eating, sleeping is necessary for living. Now what's incidental thereto? Shall not be regarded as a deviation. So it gives a heck of a lot to the employee on the one hand. It then starts to take it back. Then it gives it again to the employee. Then it takes it back. You don't know which way it should go. Okay, you're going to concede that going to dinner or lunch is part of the job. Okay.
Yes.
Wait, unless you're looking for a good restaurant, right?
Exactly.
That's right. It's the one Kate points out.
So that's right. So, I mean, does that mean that means that means you can only eat maybe in the hotel or place that you're staying, which has been assigned by your employee or employer, or you accept it. If you go outside of that restaurant or that place, even half a block, and slip, or you're hit by something, you're out of it. The same thing goes for any number of things. Going down to the gift store to buy a newspaper. That is not essential. It's not reasonably necessary for living. You would say that's out?
If the circumstances are the case that the worker is done at work at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Let's take this is his day off. He's going to stay in the hotel. He's going to eat in his room with room service. But he decides he needs a newspaper.
I think that,
where does that fall in the
I
statute?
Think that worker can be expected to leave the room, to walk, go get a newspaper, go buy a soda, things like that. I think those are all common sense type of factors that the legislature intended. But if that worker says, I have a day off, I think I'm going to go scale the tallest building in the state, somebody's going to look and say, that's ridiculous.
I have a question. Does it make any difference? And this is, I think, a very special situation. The Olympics happens once every 4 years. This person apparently has been identified with CBS before, and maybe in one of the briefs I read that particularly CBS promoted these people mingling with the populace. It's good for CBS to get their insignia out. I might say I attended the Olympics in Tokyo or in Japan not too long ago, and CBS had that, and they want to be distinguished with their logo. And part of the testimony here was that he was skiing with Peekaboo Street. Tommy Moe, and they were on the hill to maybe get some inside information or set up some type of relationship.
See, I think that is...
This was only for 3 weeks, as I understand, was the total employment.
Correct. That's the argument being made, but I don't think there's a proper evidentiary basis. CBS had plenty of people specifically assigned to downhill skiing. If they wanted information, they could have said, go interview Peekaboo Street. This individual, his marching orders were, you can do whatever you want, we don't even have to see you for the next day. And so to argue that somehow he was acting as a scout or trying to get out information for CBS, there's just no evidentiary basis to support that type of interpretation.
Counsel, you seem to stress a lot the danger of the activity. Now, where would you most apt to get hurt, driving a car or skiing?
I don't know. I think you would need to know, and what we need to explore then is getting into the sliding scale. Then they have to analyze, all right, what's the experience level of the skier?
Well,
if I go out on that hill with Peekaboo Street, I'm going to wipe out in 10 seconds.
Okay, but that's my point. My point is that I was going to move you from the gift shop in the hotel to one down 10 blocks, and he's going to take his car. And we agreed that that was reasonable for him to buy a newspaper. Now he's driving a car and he gets into an auto accident. I think that probably being injured in an auto accident is probably greater than on the ski hill.
Except that we all drive automobiles, but we all don't downhill ski on Olympic hills.
Not all of us drive automobiles. Most of the people you know drive automobiles. Not everyone drives an automobile. In certain circles, skiing is the same thing as driving an automobile. It's just an ordinary fact of life. We can take him out of the ski hill and we can have him running. And he gets hurt.
Except the way I look at this is, right now I'm a traveling employee. People can estimate or guess what I did this morning, what I did now, and what I'm going to do on my way back. One of those activities
is that you're going to change clothes and go around the lake in Madison before you drive back home.
That would be unreasonable. That I'm not going to be downhill skiing, and that's evidence that that activity is not reasonably necessary for living, and that's what the legislation requires.
Told me to take exercise. He'd like me to jog or run or do all the things that he thinks it's reasonably necessary for my living to 95.
That when you are out then walking or jogging, that's a far cry, but let's say you decide you want to go skydiving. There are limits within which you have to interpret what the intent of the legislature
is. How about bungee jumping?
Bungee jumping, I would put right in there with downhill skiing.
Let me ask you in these categories, then. It's your position, then, that if certain activities, no matter what, are going to be excluded.
Because they are not reasonably necessary for living.
So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what an employee's doctor says. It doesn't matter that this is during the Olympics and lots of people are skiing. It's certain activities, no matter what the circumstances, are not going to be. It's going to be an individual pursuit and not covered, and other activities are.
Exactly.
Now, what about things like running and jogging? Are those sometimes yes, sometimes no, or always out? Or where do you draw the line on?
It's very difficult, Justice, and I understand. But I think that jogging would probably be in a gray area, depending on, let's assume right now I decide I'm not going to drive back, I'm going to jog back. Somebody's going to say that is your own personal pursuit. You could have just as easily have driven back. It's the gentleman that goes to a restaurant 30 miles away in the Twin Cities when they're saying there's plenty of restaurants here. Once you decide to embark, you want to go to a particular one, you can do it.
The problem I have with your argument is that, now when you get into those other categories, you are looking at the individual facts of the circumstances of that you know, there are no restaurants. It's a town with no restaurants. Everything closed at 7 o'clock. And so, you know, it was reasonable to drive for 35 miles to a restaurant. On the other hand, if there are 50 restaurants, it's not reasonable. So it seems to me you are looking at the facts and circumstances, and then why would you not look at the facts and circumstances surrounding this employee?
If I can respond, because the red light's on, I am looking at it. I think that's what's significant. If CBS had employed Peekaboo Street and said, we want you to go test the hills during your off days so you can give us some insight, that would be compensable. They did not. They had a runner, and they said, you can do whatever you want. You can sit in your hotel room. He, on his own personal pursuit, said, you know, I think I might try downhill skiing, and the injury occurred. The workers' compensation is not health insurance. It's meant to be cover those injuries specifically limited to a work-related relationship. Thank you.
Justice Babbage has a question.
Counsel, through no fault of your own, I've not been helped in my biggest problem. My biggest problem is I got to write this opinion. One of us has to write this opinion. And you've said that that you draw the line at what is ever reasonably necessary for living. Well, those words are so rife with ambiguity that it's what's in my eyes, what's reasonably necessary may be entirely different than what Justice Abramson, than what Justice Wilcox, etc. That's not helpful to us, counsel. Don't you have anything a little bit more helpful in terms of scrivening?
I think you have to look at what the legislature is really trying to do. For a while, early on, if you had even a slight deviation, there was no coverage. Then people determined, probably the legislature determined, well, there has to be some flexibility, and as a result, this statute came about to say, all right, eating and sleeping, we're going to cover those, because otherwise, when you're eating dinner, you're not performing any service for your employer. Now, all we need to apply is, as the case law has indicated, a common sense, what do those words mean? What's the reasonable interpretation of those words? And when they say reasonably necessary for living, they're talking about activities that at least you as a sitting court can say our society would look upon this as a reasonably necessary activity. So yes, going to the store to buy a newspaper, perhaps even once your seminar is over, jogging for a little bit. But to suddenly embark on something completely different and completely unusual, this court can reasonably say that is not within the intent of the legislation. That it was the Workers' Compensation Act was never intended to cover literally anything and everything that the worker does once he leaves the doorstep until he comes back. And that's the current effect of the law as the Court of Appeals has written the decision. And essentially a broad sweeping decision saying essentially, well, this may or may not be. And I think that was not the intent of the legislation.
Thank you. According to my notes, Mr. Walt, you have 15 minutes and Mr. Nass has 15.
Thank you. That's correct, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Attorney Scott Walt, represents the injured employee, Mr. Camps. I'm going to be limiting my arguments today to the facts of this case and the application of the law to those facts. Mr. Nass is going, on behalf of the Attorney General's Office, representing Lurk, is going to limit his arguments to the standard of review in this case. I found it interesting listening to Attorney Ratzel's arguments today. He argues that this is an issue of law before this court, yet continually argues the facts in each specific situation. He was given situations by this court. In this case, is it covered? Is it not covered? Those are all factual determinations. First, let's turn to Lurk's decision. Lurk, as the justice has asked, who decides this case? Who decides the issues of fact? It is Lurk that makes those decisions. It's undisputed that Mr. Camps was employed by CBS from 2-6-94 through 2-7-94. He was hired for that entire time, paid $75 per day for as much work as they needed. The record shows that. He was to work all that time. I think that's why the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals got onto this on call. I think the better phraseology for that was subject to call. If you look at the facts in this case, the facts will reveal that Mr. Camps, when they went skiing, they told the producer where they were going. They told him, if you need us, we will be at the ski hill. He testified that if while they were on the ski hill with their supervisor, who suggested that, if she said, you're going back to work, they're going back to work at that point. He was under that impression. So I think the better term in this is not on call, but subject to call. Lurk didn't even address that issue. It wasn't important to them. Lurk found that the supervisor suggested that they go skiing. Lurk found CBS provided the vehicles to go skiing. Lurk found CBS provided the ski passes.
Is any of that important for their decision?
Yes, I think it all is. Because I think this case comes down basically, based upon the case law, on three issues. The first one is, you need to look at the totality of the
circumstances. What I was asking is, what if none of these facts were present, and Mr. Camp simply went skiing on his day off, subject to call? Do you think that's compensable?
You mean taking out of the equation the fact that the employer suggested it, that they supplied it ski tickets?
Yeah.
I think if the only issue is that Camps was given the day off and went skiing, I think there could be an argument that it would be compensable. Same token, it could be argued that it isn't. My point being, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. This court has said you look at the circumstances in these cases. You look at the circumstances.
What is the point of all of these circumstances? Are you claiming that somehow they were encouraging Camps to go skiing?
Well, once you look at the totality of circumstances, the issue becomes reasonableness. The court has stated...
Well, that's not my question. Please listen and answer the question. Is the point that you're trying to make, because that's what I'm hearing implicitly, that all of these things, the totality of these circumstances, amounted to encouragement by CBS that Camps go skiing? Otherwise, I don't see what the point of all of those things are.
I think part of it is encouragement. I don't think that's a big issue in this case, though. I think it's a red herring.
Are any of these important?
I think the on-call...
You said they were important.
I think the on-call is a red herring, too. I think CBS providing versus...
So then you would answer my question, then are you changing your answer to my question that if none of these were present and he went skiing, that would be compensable anyway?
You know, I don't agree with that.
Oh, counsel, I'm sorry, finish your answer, tell him why.
This is the point I'm trying to make. The question we're here for today is the facts. What are the facts? I think it's each case has to be looked at on its own. I think once you add more facts to the situation, it becomes reasonable. So if you take a situation where you just have an employee being off and going skiing, I think that's an issue as whether that is reasonable under the facts. Other things that come into that reasonable determination, the reasonableness determination, are things such as the employer saying, let's go skiing. The supervisor saying, go out and enjoy Lillehammer. Providing the transportation to the ski hills. Providing the ski lift tickets. Those things go into that determination of reasonableness. So to answer your question, is skiing per se that fact alone, is that a reasonable activity? Depends. It depends on what the trier of fact wants to decide.
I think it depends on which part of the statute you're looking at. If you look at the first sentence, it says that every employee who's traveling shall be deemed to be performing services growing out of and incidental to the employee's employment at all times while on a trip. So I think that your argument is, or might be, that here it's growing out of an incidental, and we know that because CBS provided the vehicle, they went as a group, they were subject to call, and they got free tickets. And therefore you argue that it doesn't come under the exception when engaged in a deviation for a private or personal purpose. And then you don't ever have to get to the next sentence, if that's your argument. I don't know that I'm buying it, but I think that's a reasonable argument. Then you don't have to get to the next sentence, which then defines what a deviation is. A deviation is when it's not reasonably necessary for living or incidental. That's the deviation. And that second sentence defines the exception using the same language. So it depends on which sentence you're looking at.
And I think if you continue on with the statute, then we get to the point where we're talking about today, that I notice counsel has been saying reasonably necessary for a living. Well, the remainder of that is an incidental thereto. I think
what? Necessary or incidental to reasonably necessary.
I think all those things lend into it's an issue of reasonableness for the trier of fact to determine.
Counsel, another way of approaching this is, if you look at the statute, acts reasonably necessary for living. A question that's presented is exercise, is recreation, fill in either word that you want. One seems to be more loaded than the other, but is, let's say, recreation reasonably necessary for living? Is it?
I agree with the Chief Justice.
Well,
your doctor states that activity, recreation, is good for you. You can live until age 95, so I think yes, it is.
And then the next question is this reasonable recreation?
I agree with you, and my answer to that question is yes, skiing is reasonable activity. Counsel has mentioned that this is an Olympic ski hill. The evidence doesn't show that. The evidence is that this is a general ski hill open to the public. This is not the hill that Peekaboo Street was doing her competition on. It's one that she was recreating on.
Well, counsel, your client obviously hopes that you prevail. But if I were an employee, I'm not sure I'd want you to prevail, an uninjured employee, because if you prevail, then wouldn't a company be able to put relatively severe limits on the activities that an employee can do while traveling on a business trip? I.e., CBS can say, you can't ski. I don't care if it's whatever, you can't ski because we might be held liable.
I have two answers to that question. First, the Workers' Compensation Act prohibits an employer from putting any limits that are not found in the Workers' Compensation Act. The Workers' Compensation Act does that. Secondly, that goes into my argument that it's an issue of reasonableness. If the employer does put those things on there, I think it comes into the reasonableness decision to be made by the trier of fact. But like I said, the Workers' Compensation Act prohibits employers from doing that.
Well,
cliff diving is different than skiing, then, because you could see reasonably putting that you can't do that, which would be, in my opinion, much more dangerous than skiing. So there would be some activities that you could see the employer putting in, right?
Correct. If we look at the case law on this from the Supreme Court in this state, they say what's customary, what's proper, what's typical, what's customary activity for a traveling employee. I don't think bungee jumping is something that's customary, ordinary, and proper. I don't think cliff diving, I don't think jumping out of airplanes with a parachute is something at this point in time, at least, that is customary, normal, and typical. One of the arguments that comes out is the floodgates are going to open if we find that recreation, skiing, is going to be a compensable injury under the Workers' Compensation Act. That's a public policy argument. If you look to the public policy, the two cases by this state that find any type of recreational activity being compensable for traveling employees are two cases where the person was drinking, one in Milwaukee and one in Mexico. Do we really want to send out to the world on this case that in Wisconsin it's okay to recreate by having a 0.24 blood alcohol content, but it's not okay to exercise? It's not okay to go skiing? I don't think this court wants to say that. I think for the floodgates argument that this is a specific case that has to be looked at based upon its facts. And the
right,
facts,
if I recall, even in Wisconsin, we draw lines. It's okay to drink, but you can't be in a hotel room in Green Bay and be a bus driver. You remember that case?
So
there are limits.
We had a case yesterday distinguishing what an Irish person could do and couldn't do. That's inside joke.
What would be reasonable recreation? I don't know.
Also, I am struck. Well, not struck, but have you considered subsection 1, 102.03, subsection 1, subsection C, subsection 3, which occurs right above the one that we're dealing with, where it defines what is performance growing out of and incidental to employment. And it says that an employee is not performing service growing out of and incidental to employment while engaging in a program designed to improve the physical well-being of the employee. And then when we get into the section that we're dealing with here, it talks about the exception. You know, there's a general rule that anything you do while you're traveling is this. But then it says the exception is when engaged in a deviation for a private or personal purpose. Do you think in any way those two statutes interact when you interface them?
No.
Why is that?
For one, they were developed at different times. The purpose of the traveling salesman statute, came in as a result of cases that limited employees to do what they could do. I know counsel argues it's sleep and eat, but if it's sleep and eat, I don't understand why the legislature wouldn't have said sleep and eat. I think the statute came as a result of needed changes to protect traveling employees. And this court has addressed those issues in saying that, as opposed to what counsel would say, if the statute narrows the case, this court has said that statute broadens the protection for traveling salespeople.
It broadens it, but it creates an exception for private or personal purpose. And subsection 3 talks about physical well-being as clearly being a private or personal purpose.
How isn't eating something for a person's private well-being, physical well-being? How isn't sleeping? Are we going to say to the CBS in this situation said, okay, employees, we have this swimming pool available for you too. Now they put them on a ski chalet up on top of a ski mountain. Now they said you can use this swimming pool here. Now so if he's going to the swimming pool, can't do that. So if the justices are at a conference for work and they're at a hotel, now you can only eat and sleep. You can't use the swimming pool where you're at. You can't use any of the amenities of the hotel. Where does it draw the line? Is this court going to decide every case what's reasonable and what's not reasonable? I think it's an issue for LIRC to decide.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. Mr. Nass.
Please, the court, on behalf of James E. Doyle, Attorney General, I am Lowell E. Nass, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the co-respondent in this matter, Labor and Industry Review Commission. The parties differ greatly on the standard of review to be used by this court. The petitioner incorrectly asserts that it should be a de novo review. In my brief, respondent's brief, citing case law up through Goranson and other cases in 1980, I cite specifically language from this court in the past talking of the finding in this matter as an ultimate finding of fact, and if there's reasonable and credible evidence to sustain it, it would therefore be conclusive on this court. Well, as suggested by Justice Walsh Bradley and Justice Getsky in this matter, and it seems every time I'm here, asked by the Chief Justice on this matter, we'll look to about 1980, a decision, Nottelson, decided February 7th, in which an unemployment compensation case in which the present Chief Justice noted in footnote 7 at page 116 as to whether we have a question of fact or a question of law in reviewing decisions of LURC in workers' compensation matters, the Chief Justice, citing Isaacs, The Law and the Facts from Columbia Law Review, states, one commentator wisely observed, whether a particular question is to be treated as a question of law or a question of fact is not in itself a question of fact, but a highly artificial question of law. The court...
Sounds right to me.
So I would say that if not a pure question of fact, certainly then it's a mixed question of fact and law, and that this court should grant great weight, deference, to the commission's determination in this matter.
To their conclusion or to their finding of fact? And Mr. Nass, I direct your attention to the cases in which I'm sure you are well acquainted, in which we say that in terms of constitutional questions, that the application of the facts to the Constitution is, in fact, a question of law which we decide de novo. We have a search case, you know, and the trial judge may find certain facts, and we give great deference to those facts, but when the trial judge applies those facts to the ultimate question of whether or not the search passes Fourth Amendment scrutiny, we look at that de novo, and it strikes me that this is somewhat very much the same.
Well,
whether the legal standard as set by the statute has been met.
Correct, Justice Babbage. Except what we're dealing here, as former Chief Justice George Curry used to say, I suppose you're saying, Mr. Nass, that there's always a special thing carved out for workers' compensation cases. And my reply to you is, the court has said in the past, repeatedly, that when you're dealing with agency findings of fact of a particular agency such as LURC in the workers' compensation area, it's a very special baby. You grant great weight, deference to the decisions of that agency, its ultimate findings of fact, as applied to the standards of a law, as long as it doesn't conflict with prior case law and it's a reasonable interpretation.
So you recognize, at least I believe, we are dealing with two separate questions here. We ask ourselves, first of all, what are the findings of fact that LURC found based upon the record, and they're entitled to, you know, we look through the record, and if there's any facts supporting those, we give great deference to them. But then we look to how LURC, the second area of questioning that I always have, that I subject these to in my mind, is, now how did LURC apply these facts to the law, to 10203? And I guess what you're saying, your answer to me is that unlike what we do with trial courts when it comes to constitutional facts, we should give great deference to both areas of questions.
Exactly.
What you're saying?
Exactly.
That's what the cases say, don't they?
That's what the cases say. For instance,
the statute says in 227.
Well, enduring a Court of Appeals decision, cited in my brief, 187 Wis 2nd at 472, petition for review denied by this court. There, the Court of Appeals reversed the Commission's denial of benefits because it found that there was a conflict with prior case law as to whether or not there was performing services and growing out of. That was an employee using a truck of the employer after hours with the employer's blessing and gets hurt. And similarly, in besides during NIGBOR, has the same granting of great weight deference to the commission. I would say that we have to then look at another portion, and that is the Brettel case. That's another Court of Appeals case, Brettel v. LURC, cited in my brief. And while it's a Court of Appeals case,
What is interesting in that particular one, it handles the argument of the petitioner in this matter. The petitioner is saying, this is a case of first impression. And by that, the petitioners are saying, the first skiing as a recreational activity for a traveling employee in Wisconsin. True, it is the first such case. But it is not the first case of impression for the commission, which has been applying this statute for 52 years since it was passed in 1945. And in Brettel, the Court of Appeals rejected the argument of in that particular case where it was made that it was the case of first impression in a mental case of a police officer shooting another human and whether or not that is extraordinary distress. And the court said, no, well, just because it's the first shooting by an officer doesn't mean it's the first case of first impression for the commission in deciding whether or not it meets the legal standard. The court in that case said, we owe great deference to the Lurk's application of school district and having done it for over 25 years. We have here twice the length of time with the commission applying the traveling employee statute. And I would suggest, as such, it is not a case of first impression for the commission, and it has numerous cases of deciding what is, for the Chief Justice's question of how to apply this statute, which seems to give a little, take a little, give a little, take a little, let the commission decide that on an individual case-by-case basis.
Well, if we don't, then every single issue under this statute and the whole statute becomes a de novo review in an appellate court, in the circuit court, then in the appellate court.
That is correct, and that would not be appropriate, and this court has repeatedly said that is not the proper standard to follow in workers' compensation cases. I would like to clarify for Justice Babbage his question on, I believe it was subsection C,
right,
in section 2, having to do with recreational activities. It's my understanding that that was added at a specific time in the legislative history, and the department's bulletin will show it, when employers started adding specific wellness programs on site. For instance, Land's End has a gorgeous health facility built specifically for many of their flex-time employees. And I believe it's simply put into that effect that while the Chief Justice's doctor would like to see her doing a number of activities and so forth to attain a full ripe age, that doesn't mean that simply because the state of Wisconsin decides to put in a gym in the new Justice Building that, in fact, they're going to cover every specific accident that occurs when one of the justices puts on too many weights or uses one of the stair steppers in
problem. When we put on the new gym, we're going to change that statute.
You won't have any argument from me on that. So I guess basically what we're saying is, and that was a specific statute in reference to a specific employer-provided health care wellness facilities on site.
What's your position on the CBS putting everybody in a van and taking them to the site of employment on the road? Is that covered or not covered here?
To the bottom of the ski hill to get their...
No, to their job. To their job site in this city. Is it covered?
Yes.
It's not covered under C. It says employer carpools are not covered.
That's a carpool where it's taking a non-traveling employee.
So C covers things that excludes things that are covered under F in your opinion.
Correct. F is a traveling employee statute passed in 1945, probably in reaction to that infamous YMCA camp, where this young med student, counselor, has a few hours to kill. He wasn't going to go bungee jumping. He wasn't going to go cliff diving. He was going to play tennis. something none of these justices have ever done. What happens? He gets hurt. I think he gets a tennis ball in the eye, and he loses the sight in that eye, or severely damaged. Benefits denied. Legislature passed this statute partially in reaction to that, so that acts incidental to living, necessary for living, and reasonably and incidental thereto, and I would suggest that covers a lot of recreation.
That, what about the bungee jumping?
Pardon?
What about bungee jumping?
My doctor never suggested that.
What
justice.
About? You're not going to the right doctor.
I perhaps not, but I guess what I'm saying is that I think there are certain limits. But the proof is in the taste of the pudding.
Well, why isn't this beyond the line? Bungee jumping, maybe. You pause. But, I can see it, that Wisconsin Supreme Court says alpine skiing reasonably necessary for living. It sounds a little bizarre.
Why not? I mean, the rhetorical question is asked in a petitioner's brief, what would Professor Larson think of this?
What would he think of it?
Rest his soul. I would ask the court to take judicial notice that Professor Larson skied, dove, swam, and not only that, he was towed out in North and South Dakota behind cars with a rope on skis. What would Professor Larson say about this?
He'd say it's not covered by workers.
No, one of the interesting parts of this case is that opposing counsel started off with telling us where the facts went wrong. Usually this court isn't in the quote making factual findings. And I was just reading through the Lurk findings here, such as bolstering the decision that, assuming that Lurk was going to come to, that such as they could do anything they wanted, but the immediate supervisor suggested that they go skiing as a group, the providing of vehicles, the finding that the employer provided the applicant with free lift tickets, which was, quote, challenged here by opposing counsel. It seems that you were trying to fit something into a certain category, and that is skiing here. And without those facts, without the supervisor, the vehicles, the free lift tickets, would we be coming to a different decision?
Probably. But it certainly helps Mr. Camps in this case. But I would suggest, as I said before, what's reasonable for a traveling employee? The proof is in the taste of the pudding. Chief Marks, in the City of Phillips case, was crossing a Milwaukee street at 2 in the morning with 0.024 blood alcohol, hit by two cars. And in the Hansen case, that traveling salesman was down, crossed the border into Mexico at the cavern, and was seen at 1:30 in the morning at a night spot. The proof is in the taste of the pudding. Mr. Camps may hobble a little bit on his knee, but he's alive.
Thank you, Mr. Noss.
Has his life improved?
Pardon?
Has his life improved? Was the chief compensable?
Yes, there was a widow in that case.
Just racking.
A couple quick points. The Phillips case that he's talking about, the only reason that was compensable is because the court said there's no evidence to indicate what he was doing at the time of the actual assault. I think it's assumed that he was assaulted. Because there's this presumption, it was determined, all right, given that we don't have any evidence of what the worker was doing, the presumption is going to stand and the worker is going to recover. In this case, we know exactly what Mr. Camps was doing. It's interesting that under Attorney Noss's perception, there would be no right of appeal of a Lurk decision. Because every single thing that Lurk does, Attorney Noss is going to say, you got to give deference to Lurk. What do we do when Lurk does say that bungee jumping or cliff diving is reasonable?
Well, if it's an unreasonable decision of Lurk, we just overturn it. It's just that if there are several reasonable positions of Lurk, and Lurk has taken one of them, if you give him deference, that's it. So it has to be unreasonable. I mean, that's if you accept that standard of view. If you don't accept that standard of view, it's elsewhere.
I think in looking at the standard for Lurk also, it cannot be forgotten that while the statute has been around, essentially this is a case of first impression. Simply because Lurk has been in existence, there is not that amount of case law and interpretation by Lurk to establish that they have a pattern or a methodology that they're following in applying the Workers' Compensation Act concerning recreation. There's only isolated cases out there. Secondly, as I indicated earlier, Lurk is being called not to address employment considerations. You're being asked to interpret what did the legislature mean when we had to decide what is reasonably necessary for living. Lurk does not have any special expertise in deciding what you or I need to live and function in society. They have expertise in who's the employer, what is the wage, things like that. But the statute requires some very narrow and particularized reading that Lurk has not established such a track record as showing what is necessary for living.
Would you address the argument raised and discussed with the Chief Justice in that if we adopt the argument that you're making now, then each one of these is a de novo review at the circuit court level as to whether or not this particular activity under these circumstances is compensable?
I don't think it becomes that, only because there's plenty of case law in the workers' compensation arena in which the statute is vague and ambiguous. That's not unusual. What is unusual, however, is Lurk going beyond what is clearly a reasonable interpretation. I think the statute is clear and unambiguous. If it says you have to give plain meaning to what the legislature did